Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Compliance Guy. After a 2-week layoff, we are back with almost the entire team. I want to start off by wishing our very good friend Stephanie Howard a speedy recovery. I know she is taking it easy. She is back to work for the first time today, but I don't think she was up to dealing with the aggravation that I cause everybody on this panel. So we're going to give her today. And I will admit that I have already had to apologize to Terry and Christine before we went live today, because I am just, I'm aggravated. And
you're passionate.
I'm passionately aggravated. How's that? All right. So I want to say hello to Paul, Christine, Terry, and Scott. Welcome, ladies and gents. And to each and every single one of y'all tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with us across the country, across the planet. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day and spending just a little bit of time with us today. So we have two topics that we're going to talk about today. We're going to take on the lesser of two evils first. And that one is the G2211. This is a code that is causing a lot of indigestion. And at this point, I have taken Dexalant, I have taken Omeprazole, and I have taken 4 Tums, and I still have heartburn from some of the stuff that I have heard while I was out last week. So Terry, I want to start with you first, because I know you had an equal amount of heartburn. We're not going to mention names. We're not going to mention anything like that. We're simply going to mention the facts. So let's get after this one.
So I can't mention names. Are you sure? All right, fine.
Okay, let me give a disclaimer. The opinions and words used by those appearing on the Compliance Guy program are of theirs only and not those of the host or doctor's management. Okay, yeah. Terry, you are free to say whatever you want to say.
That's why we love podcasts, because there's only a minimal filter. We just can't use too much profanity, or Apple Podcast says no, no, no. You know, nobody wants to throw another consultant or, you know, healthcare professional under the bus. So I will try not to do that. Try. But when I hear things that people say out there, and I'm sure all of us have heard it, and we're just like face planting and shaking our head and thinking, how can you be somebody who is in the industry and considered to be a respected voice, and then putting something out there that's so blatantly inappropriate that can cause, you know, harm to other practices, you know? And the one thing that I appreciate our listeners is that when you hear this stuff, and, you know, shout out to, you know, Betty and everybody that's out there, you direct message me or Christine or Sean and Paul and Scott and say, hey, did you by any chance see this or hear this? And we're like, yeah, unfortunately. So when we talk about the G2211, we know that's the new add-on code that's going to be the bane of our existence for that complex, serious condition patient that the physician or I guess now NPP, but really physician, in my opinion, is in the long haul for the patient. They call it the longitudinal care. And it means basically that you're not just managing their chronic conditions, but anything they need on the peripheral for that, you know, if you need to make sure that they get the home health they need, if you need to make sure that, you know, they have access to the medications they need, you know, whatever they need to manage and hopefully recover, but to deal with this, you know, chronic serious condition that they keep talking serious. Well, the problem is that we have not been given a lot of guidance by CMS when it comes to frequency. I get all the time people are saying how often. We're not getting guidance as far as they did say that NPPs can use them, which are non-physician providers that are QHPs that can bill directly to the payer for an E&M. But when you look at it, in real time, are they really the ones managing it or is it the physician? And my big issue is new patient visits. How do you know you're in a longitudinal relationship until you've assessed the patient? So to me, I don't think that's appropriate, but I can't tell you it isn't because they included those codes. So here's where the problem is. There was a consultant out there who shall not be nameless that basically said, bill it on everything and see what happens. Okay, that's like us telling you, you know what? Ignore the bundling guidelines, ignore billing rules, ignore payer contracts, and throw spaghetti at a wall and hope it gets paid. People, too much of a good thing is too much. And just because we now are allowed certain services, G2211 being one of them, prolonged care, the G2212 being another one, you know, what is the pelvic exam, the 99459, the SDOH, you know, the G0136. These services are there because we're trying to capture things that may not be accounted for in the value of an E&M service. And so this is where we've been given a gift. And, you know, don't be gift horse in the mouth. Don't be putting something on it if it's not appropriate. And the other thing is, let's say you'd have to defend yourself. And I know Sean and I have had conversations about this offline and on our hashtag Terry Tuesday. You know, having to defend yourself is not a good place to be, especially in a legal position. And if you have a judge or you have an arbiter or you have any payer personnel that's saying to you, how do you justify that on every single patient encounter? You're not going to be able to. You're just not. And so from, you know, from a CDI auditor and somebody who all audits for both sides of the aisle, it's a problem. And so I'm actually going to throw this one over to Paul, because Paul, I know you're dealing with this and I'd like to get your take on this about bill it on everything. No, yeah. Don't.
Remember a few weeks ago when I tied in diagnostic assignment, ICD-10 assignment to this code? Something to think about when you say, oh, let's just bill it on everything. You know, well, everything includes a skin rash. Everything includes a common cold. Everything includes strep throat. These are not things that qualify for G2211. There better be a really good reason for you to add this service that goes beyond the complexity of an evaluation and management service. You have to remember that. It's not something that is integrated into the complexity of the visit. This is something wholly separate, you know, because it's on a separate line item. It's on line number 2. It begins with a G. You know, that's what we do with those things. It's not something that can be tied to the complexity of the E&M service. So very important to add. I mean, these are complex or serious conditions. You know, I doubt very strongly that there are doctors out there, even though if I had a dime for every doctor who said, well, all of my patients are sick, I would have retired 10 years ago. You know, not every patient that comes into your practice is very sick, you know, even if you are a specialist. You know, sometimes it's just an assessment for something the primary care physician found. And then, as Terry stated, at that new visit, you're going to establish that longitudinal relationship. But that documentation has to be there, and the severity of the diagnosis code has to be there, because you're going to be assigning one to that service in order to get it paid.
Go ahead, Christine. I know you got something that you wanted to say on here.
Oh, he's got something to say, huh? Here's the thing. This could be the code that tilts the scale for us. This could be the code that throws our budget off. This is the code that may decrease reimbursement to the other specialties that may not be appropriate to report this code. And you've been hitting it on the head repeatedly. There has to be some value there. Think about when it is appropriate. Remember, let's go historically. Remember in the beginning of COVID, everybody started doing all of these telehealth and they were doing it wrong. And now the OIG has released 9 reports and they've got ongoing audits and clawbacking money. And we're seeing that. Think about history, folks. Every time that there is this new, wonderful, great thing that anybody can do, the audits come later and the recoupments come later, and they can be detrimental to a practice. I know we're talking about a code that averages between $15 and $19, but if you're adding that onto every single patient and then you're aggregating that over the next year, 2 years, by the time the audits catch up to us, that's going to be a pretty big paycheck to have to fork out. You may not be prepared for that. The other thing is, when we think of the reasons why maybe Medicare wants to encourage that longitudinal relationship, think about how costly it is for those patients that doctor hop. They had a bad experience with this doctor, so they're going to another doctor. There's another new patient visit. There's another full diagnostics that are run. That's very costly. So when I think longitudinal, I'm expecting to see in documentation that the patient should return if the conditions worsen. These are the things they should be looking for. They should call the office if they have any additional questions. We will see them again in 3 months. Like for me, that shows that there is a serious condition and that there's that longitudinal care that we're working towards. That's just my two cents on the whole thing, guys.
Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, one of the things that jumped out at me, you know, just see what happens is the kind of advice I would give somebody if they were going on like a speed dating event or something, you know, like I don't think there are many scenarios involving the billing of a federal healthcare plan for money where I would say, well, just see what happens, right? And I don't know that there are many good examples in our work where that's the advice we would want to be giving to people in general. And I think everybody else in the group has talked about the good examples or scenarios to be thoughtful about. I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about is as we transition to the new guidelines, one of the things that we've talked about is how it's really up to the rendering provider to enhance the severity potentially of an acute problem by explaining the manner in which a patient's established chronic disease or other health complications may impact that. And when I think about these types of relationships in G2211, that's the type of documentation that I'm thinking about. I mean, unfortunately, we were little, you know, I think a couple of the commenters have talked, I see Charmaine's comment about everyone having so many different opinions on G2211. I'm seeing that as well, right? And I think those things are important because we see examples from CMS where they talk about the management of an acute condition. But my expectation would be, as others have pointed out, that if I'm just showing up at the doctor for a sore throat, that wouldn't be a G2211 case. I had one provider use it for a new patient visit in an audit I did last week. And I mean, the examples where I could see it potentially being applicable to a new patient visit, I'm sure I could come up with some, right? Like I have three chronic conditions and I just moved to a new city and I'm seeing the provider who's going to manage those conditions for the first time. And we've come out of that appointment with the understanding that it was successful enough that we're going to continue, right? In this case, this provider basically said, you know, the patient's going to go have a test done. And depending upon that test, I may or may not need to see the patient again. It's like, well, I'm not quite sure we've established a good longitudinal relationship based on that statement.
Yeah. So listen, there are some great comments that are coming in. You know, LaDonna makes me think of the Oprah Winfrey show when it used to be on. You get a car, you get a car, everyone gets a car. Well, it's the same thing. You get a G2211, you get a G2211, everyone gets the car. Here's the problem, right? The fact of the matter is, if all of a sudden you begin to bill a code that you have no historical relationship with, even though it's a new code, but you come out of the gate like Secretariat running for the Triple Crown.
Oh, that I know.
Anytime you get a 70s horse reference in, we're good.
There you go. The payers are data mining. Folks, I've said this 100 times, and I'll say it 100 more. The payers know what your utilization patterns are better than you do, because they're looking at your utilization patterns all the time, which is why we always encourage you to run your utilization reports by provider, by payer, by CPT code, by modifier, by diagnosis code, because that is the only way you can begin to mitigate your risk. The things that are so important about new procedure codes, new service codes, is in the absence of definitive guidance, or in the event you see multiple guidance documents coming out in a quick period of time from the MACs or from CMS, it is always best to pause. Read between the lines, because we're going to talk about reading between the lines in a few minutes here on something else. Read between the lines, because messages sometimes get skewed and you get the grapevine effect, or you get individuals. And again, I was out of all communication last week. I'm going to play dumb because I don't know. Okay, I can't play dumb. I do know who said it, and it is mortifying to me that it was said. This is not a code that you simply apply and bill all the time to everyone and see what happens. There's no such thing, and there's nothing good that comes from bill it to everyone on every single encounter and see what happens. Folks, I spend the majority of my time preparing for civil or criminal trials in federal court, arbitrations, state courts, mediations, and I will tell you, nothing good comes from telling people, just bill it and see what happens. That is absolutely horrific and mortifying to me. The best thing to do is to create a policy. Sit down with the compliance professionals in your organization, the coding professionals, the auditing professionals. Sit down with leadership. Get the clinicians involved. Because I think one of the most important things that you have to define is, what is a longitudinal relationship? It is not clearly defined. And when something is not clearly defined, you have to take it upon yourselves to do your diligence and to create a policy that says, in the absence of definitive guidance from the Centers for Medicare or Medicaid Services and or from our local Medicare administrative contractor, we believe that using the G2211 in the following instances would be appropriate. The reason why I say that is, in the event you ever have to go before a Unified Program Integrity Contractor Investigator, an OIG special agent, a prosecutor from the Department of Justice, or God forbid, they've convened a grand jury because they believe that you violated with intent 18 U.S.C. Section 1347, which is conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud, you can sit there and say, we acted in good faith. As part of our overall compliance program, we created a definitive policy in the absence of definitive guidance from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Now, we may not be 100% correct, but this was our interpretation in the face of there not being definitive documentation for us to follow. And that creates doubt in the minds of a jury and or a judge if it's a bench trial, or an arbiter if it's an arbitration, to where you say, we acted in good faith. We used our best judgment. We made a concerted effort by having our physicians, our nurse practitioners, our PAs, our administration, our compliance, whoever it is that you can get buy-in from to help draft this policy. And my recommendation is, it should go through multiple iterations. Don't just take the very first thing that you draft and put it into play. This is something, especially where there is such a lot of chatter out there right now with this code, you got to be careful. Now, let me go to Christine, because I think you probably have some really good advice and some reminders that you want to give. And then I want to come back to Terry, Paul, and Scott for some closing comments on this one.
Well, Sean, you hit it right on the head. I think that the answer to everything should not be just throw it against the wall. It should be, like you said, get together with compliance, put it to the committee, develop a policy for your organization, educate everyone involved, and then monitor it. Maybe you have to revise the policy. Maybe we get new information that comes in. But until then, there's something there. The other thing is, I've been watching some of the coding Facebook pages, and I warn everyone about those coding Facebook pages. Facebook is not the place to get your education. Facebook, I know you're laughing, Paul, but you know it's true. I read through some of those comments and I cringe sometimes because of the misinformation that is being done. Just because you're doing it in your office doesn't mean you're doing it right. So the chatter I'm hearing is that they're billing all payers G2211. And some payers are actually reimbursing G2211. Is that appropriate? This is a Medicare code and the guidance came out from Medicare. And if those commercial insurances don't have a policy or have added it to their specific fee schedules, could we later be looking at an overpayment that exceeds beyond the federal, but into the states now that commercial insurances are paying maybe erroneously for it, or they haven't given guidance for it? So just think about that. It's not just or not Blue Cross and Blue Shield will pay it, but are they paying it right? Will they come back later and ask for their money? Is that going to open the door for audits on the commercial side as well? So there's a lot of things that need to go into consideration. Take it to that compliance committee first.
All right. Scott, Paul, Terry, who wants to go next?
I'll take it. You know, that when I hear the words, just build on everything and see what happens, you know where I've heard those words before? I've heard them in surgical practices where I question why they're putting the 59 modifier on every other line item when they're billing it out. And I explain to them why that's not a very good idea. So that sounds very, very familiar. And I would be remiss as an employee of Doctors Management if I didn't point out that tonight we have a physician education event at 7 p.m. Eastern Time that goes into the documentation standards for G2211. I can provide the link for Sean and he can share it with the audience.
Yeah, I and I love Angela Jordan. You know, the fact that she just put out the fact that last week was the quarterly provider outreach education and advisory group from Wisconsin Physician Services. I can only imagine what transpired during that call and the requests for information and what needed to be in the medical records in order to be able to support and substantiate the billing of the G2211. And I think it was great to hear that, you know, the folks that were on the call with WPS said, hey, we need you to put this stuff into an educational, you know, outreach in writing so that, you know, everyone understands what the expectations are. And again, you know, whether they do that or not, I don't know. I will say this, WPS happens to be one of the really solid Macs out there. I go to them quite often because I really think they're ahead of the curve compared to some of the other, you know, Macs that are out there. Okay. One last thing that I want to say is this. If, God forbid, you get targeted for an investigation and that investigation turns into a referral for civil or criminal prosecution, you cannot go into a courtroom and say, we just don't have the time to review the guidelines and the statutes and acts and laws that are out there. We're too busy treating patients. That will never fly in the courtroom. You have to make time for this. And if you as a provider can't make the time, then you have to employ reasonable individuals who have the ability and are willing to go the extra mile to do the necessary research to provide you with the bullet points and the information that you need to be able to make an educated decision on how you're going to proceed. Simply putting on a blindfold and playing pin the tail on the donkey is not the way that you should be billing for these services. You have got to be smart about this stuff. And you know, I'll leave it at that. All right. Go ahead, Scott, please.
Yeah, the one thing I just wanted to reiterate that you said, Sean, that I think was really insightful is the importance of having, you know, sitting down and within the construct of your office, like designing the policies or scenarios by which providers should use G2211, whether that provider is primary care, whether that provider is a specialist, or whether that provider is even a surgeon. I mean, I wasn't there for all the meetings where this code got baked up, but, you know, I know I was on one session about this code, and I mentioned that it wasn't really intended for surgeons. And the first thing I heard was, of course, a surgeon chiming in to say how often he or she remains involved in the care of the patients forever. And my feeling is, you know, it was a lot easier for CMS to say, well, we'll just put these very vague descriptors around it and give it to the masses to figure out. But you have to understand, you know, if you are a surgeon, you probably shouldn't be, you know, using this as often as, say, a primary care provider. And you really should be thoughtful about, and I think that was really the best guidance, because in some of these, you know, some of these facilities with hundreds of providers, it's part of your compliance plan to understand that you've got consistent policies for the implementation of this so that providers are hopefully using it consistently based on that shared understanding, and that you in compliance can audit and adjust based on that, because you'll inevitably find you'll put the guidance out and one provider is using it on every patient and one provider is never using it. And if they're both in primary care, there's a good chance they're both wrong in some ways. And so that's what I think that written guidance helps with.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's move on to our next topic, because I think this one's going to be as equally charged. And I know many of you, and please, if you think you know Incident 2, stick around, because I think, again, like the G2211, there are so many opinions that are out there. There are so many individuals wishing to opine on Incident 2 that it becomes quite tricky as to who and what you should be listening to, and what is the difference between a best practice versus what is the actual cited guidance. In the Code of Federal Regulations, CFR, we're going to talk about CFR. We're going to talk about 42 CFR, section 424.510A2 to get us started. And then we're going to transition over to talking about section 60.1 of the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual. We'll talk about 2050.1. And then I want to finish out with a quick conversation on what is CMS's actual position on this stuff. So for those of you that are newer to healthcare, those of you that are newer to the concept of Incident 2 services, this is something that is referred to as a provisional billing service, okay? Incident 2 is a specific term to Medicare. Now, many of you may be sitting there thinking to yourself, but Sean, we do have commercial payers that we participate with who have adopted Incident 2 as part of their, you know, policies or their, you know, their payment mechanism for remuneration to physicians using auxiliary personnel. And that may be true. But what you are going to find most likely is, even if it's a Medicare Advantage plan, they are not obligated to comply with CMS's actual provisions of Incident 2. Medicare Advantage plans have unilateral discretion to be able to create policies and procedures that fit to their processing and or adjudication of claims. And I think Christine, Paul, Scott, Terry, their experience will tell you all the same. Now, Christine makes a very good point. She wants me to remind everybody, and I'm going to, that we are not talking about collaboration agreements, okay? Collaboration agreements are requirements that are established by the State Nurse Practice Act in each state, where nurse practitioners don't have the freedom to practice independent of a supervising physician. in certain states, they are required to have a collaboration agreement, meaning that a physician has to be involved in the clinical judgment, the clinical decision-making, the development of plans of care, and they have to countersign their notes, depending on the frequency of what, you know, what the state law requires. Now, incident two, in simple terms, are services performed by auxiliary personnel as if a physician and or a supervising non-physician, if they are permitted by state law to supervise auxiliary personnel, have those individuals such as RNs, LPNs, MAs, techs, rendering services on their behalf as if they were rendering the services themselves and then billing for those services for a direct remuneration or reimbursement. Panel, everybody good so far? Okay. Now, the one thing that I want to say is
one more
this.
Time. I think it's important one more time just to reiterate that we're talking about something that is not that collaboration agreement for licensing, that we are not talking about that arrangement that the doctor hired the nurse practitioner in the office. We're talking about contractual obligations with a payer of how you get paid. And there's a huge divide between those two requirements. Collaboration has nothing to do with your contracts on how you get paid. I just wanted to make that real clear, because when I go into a practice, this is the one thing that we hear the most. Oh, they work for the group, so we bill everything under the doctor. That's has right. nothing to do with your payment contracts.
That's right. That's such a great point. And I'm grateful that you made that. Now, in the event that you do not meet all of the requirements to satisfy the billing of services by auxiliary personnel under direct supervision of a physician, those services cannot be billed as incident two. And in those cases, they will default to being billed under the NPI number of the individual who rendered the service. Now, this is where it gets tricky. And I want to say this before I go any further. Incident two services are not simple. They're not. They are the most complex of all provisional billing services. A one-page FAQ from a MAC is not the guidance document that is going to answer all of the questions, because FAQs are frequently asked questions. And some folks don't ask very specific questions because they rely, like we said before, on others who may or may not be fully informed. Now, a big dispute has arisen over whether or not a nurse practitioner working incident to a supervising physician as an auxiliary personnel has to actually be credentialed with Medicare. Now, there are many people who have said, yes, definitively, if you are a nurse practitioner and you are rendering services incident to, you have to credential with Medicare. No, you don't. And let me explain this to you, okay? So again, I don't like to deal in hypotheticals because I can't argue hypotheticals in court when I'm sitting on the stand. I can only argue authoritative information. I can only argue what I know from a regulatory standpoint either exists or doesn't exist in a statute, act, code, or law. So very quickly, let's take the first, okay? And I want to talk about 42 CFR section 424.510A2. And what it says is, quote, any non-physician provider rendering services for reimbursement by Medicare must be enrolled in Medicare. Okay, let's unpack that. What it says is, under the Code of Federal Regulations, if you are a non-physician provider who is rendering services and you are going to be reimbursed for those services under your NPI number, then you must be enrolled in Medicare. The section that I'm talking about speaks to the fact that if you want to receive a direct remuneration, meaning a reimbursement, billing under your own NPI number, then you have to be enrolled in Medicare. Nowhere in the Code of Federal Regulations section does the aforementioned bring up anything about working incident two. As a matter of fact, what the centers, and I'm going to post all of these citations in just a little while for you. CMS gives an actual citation on this section, and here's what it says. Nurse practitioners are not required to enroll in Medicare if they are not having services billed under their NPI number. It goes on to state, quote, further, NPs, CNMs, CNSs, and PAs may enroll. Doesn't say you must. It doesn't say you are required. It says you may enroll as one of these licensed professionals and get payment from us, meaning CMS, for incident to services and supplies provided by auxiliary personnel that they supervise. It doesn't say that if you as a non-physician practitioner are working incident to a physician as an auxiliary professional, you have to enroll in Medicare. It says if you are having services rendered under your supervision by auxiliary personnel, then you must enroll in Medicare. It's a direct remuneration. Folks, there are several sections of the Program Integrity Manual. And, you know, I don't want folks to get bored with this stuff, but I do want to make sure that I give you the proper citations and places to look. So let me quickly share this with you. And then I want to go to Christine and Terry and Paul and Scott, because I want to talk about best practices. I want to talk about being smart operationally. Okay, so let's take a quick look at a few things here. So this is section 60.1, which is incident to physician professional services. Okay, this section here defines exactly what incident to services are. Now, the section I want you to focus on is 60.1B, and I want you to look at this second paragraph. Auxiliary personnel means any individual who is acting under the direction, under the supervision of a physician, regardless of whether the individual is employed, least employed, or independent contractor of the physician. Okay? This is critical because remember, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services specifically said, we left the term auxiliary personnel general to say any individual because we did not want to limit who could function as an auxiliary personnel. As a matter of fact, there's an FAQ out there that says, can a non-enrolled but licensed physician in the state work incident to a Medicare enrolled and credentialed physician? And the answer is yes, they can. So if a physician who has a higher degree of education, right, can work incident to another physician as an auxiliary professional, why could a nurse practitioner or a PA not work incident to as a non-enrolled, non-credentialed provider under an enrolled and credentialed provider? Okay, so I know this is not a webinar, and I apologize, but this is a topic that is extremely important to me because of the number of cases that I see on a yearly basis, the number of attorneys that reach out to me, the fact that I have engaged with the Office of Inspector General on creating a study to ferret out fraud, waste, or abuse back in 2017, the fact that I consult with the Department of Justice prosecutors from time to time on this stuff, and hearing so many varying opinions of people saying, definitively, you have to do this or you can't get remunerations, I can't sit by quietly and not make sure the actual guidance is out there. Now, I'm going to pause and I'm going to stop the webinar here. And I would like Terry, Christine, Paul, and Scott, I would love for you all to please opine on this and give your thoughts. And I'm going to mute myself.
This is I wanted to jump in and say that I love your perspective, Sean. I really do. I look at things sometimes from a different perspective because I'm working with the boots on the ground people in the office. And I just want to remind everyone in the office of a couple of things here. By the time that you need Sean and you need that information, you have already put out hundreds, if not thousands of dollars in staff time, in attorney fees, in consultant fees. So while what Sean is saying, it's absolutely a fact, we need to also think about from that proactive perspective there. And I don't want anybody to get the message that your NPs do not have to be credentialed with Medicare. They have to be if they're going to participate with the Medicare program, period. Remember, what Sean is saying is if they are not participating with the Medicare program and they're following that tiny window of incident two, where this is an incidental visit where the patient previously saw the physician initiated a plan of care, and all our NP is doing is staying in that bubble. Nothing outside, no labs that are outside of the norm or outside of that plan of care, no medications out of that plan of care, no referrals outside of that plan of care. It's a tiny window to make incident two. Otherwise, you have one of two choices. If they're not credentialed, you don't get paid. That the other idea is that they have to be credentialed in order to get paid if we don't meet that tiny window of incident two. That's, in my opinion, the message that we give boots on the ground. Once we're beyond boots on the ground and you do need the attorney and you do need the consultant and you need Sean, then Sean does have that perspective where these are the wiggle rooms there. These are the facts about it. But before you get there, think about how much that's going to cost your practice. And, you know, having that NP credentialed, it's not that difficult of a task.
And Christine, I'm going to give you 1 second. I don't want people to think I am saying you don't have to credential or you shouldn't credential your MPs. I think you should. I think there are so many red flags with incident two, and there are so many what if scenarios that you can quickly run afoul of violating incident two guidelines. So I'm not saying in any way, shape, or form, don't get your NPs or PAs credentialed. What I'm saying is if they are truly functioning in the role as an auxiliary professional, following a plan of care with no adjustments to that plan of care, they are not seeing an initial visit, because remember, they can't see an initial visit anyways for incident two. It has to be a physician to create the plan of care. If they are focusing in and they are operating in that small window, they don't have to be credentialed with Medicare, according to Medicare's own clarifications. Terry, I'm sorry. I know you wanted to say something, and I apologize. Go ahead.
No. There's something beyond the incident too here that I think is being missed about what credentialing does. Credentialing vets some people. And so I've had practices that have not done credentialing, whether it be for private payer and Medicare. And let's say that, you have a provider that says, a physician says, okay, I'm going to follow this advice where technically the Federal Register says I don't have to, you know, have my NP credentialed. Okay. So now they're going to be seeing patients underneath their provider number. Let's say they even meet all the rules of incident two, but they weren't credentialed. Who's vetting them? Who's making sure they're actually a legal nurse practitioner? Who they haven't had any violations in your state. They haven't been kicked out of another state. They're able to treat patients. Nobody else does that. Credentialing vets that person, doesn't just get them approved so that they can, so you can get money. It makes sure that you have a valid healthcare practitioner, that they are who they say they are. And I can't tell you, I'm in my 40th year of healthcare. I just aged myself. I just made sure that, you know, I see a lot of, and I've seen, unfortunately, it's a small percentage, but it's enough. If it even happens once, it's scarier than anything. It's kind of like, if you've ever watched Suits, where, you know, Mike Ross wasn't an actual attorney. It's my favorite show. And so then he, you know, all his cases are going to be questioned because he pretended to be an attorney. Well, if you pretend to be a healthcare provider, nobody's making sure that you are. And again, even if you were, but you're not current, or you don't, you didn't get your license renewed, or again, you have something in your background that wasn't vetted by the credentialing process. Now you've put your patients at risk. You've put your malpractice at risk. You've put your whole practice at risk. So for me, even though there is a regulatory technical option here, if Sean has to get you out of trouble, that's basically what he's saying. He's saying, guess what? If it comes up, I can get you out of trouble. But I think we're all on the same page saying, don't get to that point. Credential your providers, whether they be physicians, whether they be nurse practitioners, PAs, any kind of level of staff that needs to be licensed in the state. And then remember one thing, and I know that Paul and Scott, I know they want to get in here. One of the things that I think is missed too is, remember, federal is one thing, state's another. And when we talk about supervision, when we talk about who can do what, for example, in Florida, in Christine's state, even though she's right now coming into us from Alaska right now, in her state, you can't be supervised by a non-physician practitioner. You have to be supervised by a physician. I'm in California, same thing, but there's an exception. Yes, a nurse practitioner, no, the PA. So it depends on your state. They let you do whatever you want in Montana. I don't know what they're doing up there, but you know what? You can do whatever you want. So, but all I'm saying is that there's also state issues, and it's just, I'm seeing a lot of people show up to practices, even with RNs, and they're saying, I'm an RN. And then you go to look and they're an LVN. I mean, how many of you, and I'm talking to our listeners, have hired somebody who says, I'm a CPC, and they're not even a coder. So, I mean, it starts at the top and goes down. And so I know I'm kind of ranting here, but I just think the credentialing process goes beyond incident two when it comes to Medicare. It has to do with vetting that person and making sure you don't have to then go to a private investigator.
And let me say this one last thing, and then Scott, I'm going to give you and Paul the final word on incident two, because Terry, you brought up something that really made me think about the vetting of a person, right? So if you look at 42 CFR, section 424.510 D1 and 42 CFR 424.515. That section actually talks about the fact that if an individual who is acting under the supervision of a physician or another practitioner has had their Medicare enrollment revoked, they are not eligible as a non-credentialed individual to engage in providing any type of service. So you're right. The credentialing process tells us, has this person ever been convicted of a felony? Have they been expelled from the Medicare or Medicaid or federal payer programs? Or have they suffered a revocation of their billing number? Because if somebody has had a revocation of their billing number, it wouldn't matter whether they were credentialed or not credentialed. There's no way they could participate. So that's a great point. So, okay, Scott, I know you had a couple of things that you wanted to say on this, so please do.
Yeah, I was just going to say not to do incident two because it's too much trouble. But beyond that, you know, I think you know, with regard to the credentialing, I mean, it's probably an oversimplified thing to say, but when your incident two plan gets screwed up because the patient has a new problem or something like that, right? Like if the nurse practitioner is not eligible to bill the service, then the service essentially is like unbillable. The other thing I'd say about incident two, more from a practical matter, like I've been thinking about incident two too much. And, you know, one of the problems with incident two that I have, the way I try to explain it when people insist on doing it, despite my first piece of advice, is, you know, it's almost like everything is like an assembly line in life, right? And there's a patient assembly line as they go through the practice, right? Like they make the appointment, they get their insurance validated, they check in, they see the provider, they check out. And what makes incident two different is somewhere in that room, when you have these two people, the provider and the patient, it can completely change the tenor of how the service gets billed. And the problem with virtually every client I work with that has some sort of incident two is they just assume it's going to go a certain way. And then the patient's in the room and the patient says, well, wait a minute, now my right ankle hurts too. And now you've got this whole other piece, but nobody has stopped the assembly line, right? Like nobody has said, well, wait a minute, like we have to go this way. And in some respects, the only way to really do that that I can think of is the nurse practitioner, the PA, has to be the one who has that like toggle switch where they clearly understand incident two and not incident two, and they can take it off one set of train tracks and put it on the other. And so to me, like that's the thing I always want to say about incident two. I mean, I think this has been a great discussion, but whenever I think about whether the NP should be credentialed or not or enrolled, my first thought is, well, it gets screwed up so often that somebody's got to bill it. You know, and if the person's not able to bill it, then that's the first problem. And the last thing I'll say about this, because I continue to get asked this 3 years after the fact, you cannot call the physician in to cobble together a treatment plan for the one new thing. And that used to be the sort of outlying exception where it's like, well, I don't have a plan of care for this new back pain. Let's get the doctor in here to scribble some notes down. So you can't do that anymore. So once that new problem comes up, you're off the tracks, right? And I think that's one of the reasons why we are always so reluctant to embrace incident two, because there's just a million ways to do it wrong and scant ways to do it right.
Yep. We have just spent about 35 minutes talking about this topic. And I go back to what Scott started out his last comment with. Is all of this really worth 15% of a 99214?
No.
Really? Really? I mean, this is the hill you want to die on to get 15% of a 99214?
I agree with you 100%. And listen, the reason why I was so passionate about this topic was because when I saw that Terry and Christine and y'all wanted to talk about the G2211 and knowing what a poop show that code is and has become, I had to take on incident two because of the misinformation and the lack of clear understanding between conjecture and what the guidelines actually say.
Well,
I appreciate everyone's perspective, because you're right. I am grateful for all who have to reach out to me, but I wish you didn't. Because had you followed the rules in advance, had you engaged with people that were qualified and competent to give you the right answers, or maybe you had them and you just decided, I'm going to do things my way, like Frank Sinatra. Well, unfortunately, now you're in a situation where it's going to cost you for legal representation and regulatory compliance professionals such as myself, Christine, Terry, Paul, Scott. So with that said, I want to thank everyone for a spirited conversation. I want to thank Christine and Terry and Paul and Scott for keeping the conversation well balanced and making sure that we were filling in all of the special little nooks and crannies on the English muffin so that we didn't leave any portion mistreated. All right. This takes us right to the end of our Monday auditing, coding, and compliance roundtable. I am so grateful for each and every single one of you that have tuned in, logged on, and hung out with us, for all of you that have posted such great comments and great questions throughout this entire episode. We appreciate it. Keep them coming. Direct message us. Let us know what's going on. Terry and I will be back tomorrow with a very entertaining hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. We're looking forward to that. I'll be back later this week with a great interview with a special guest on Thursday of the Compliance Guys. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.